Get road trip ready with a service checkup at your local Chevy dealer. They can save you time and money and get the job done right the first time, worry-free. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for current service specials or to schedule a test drive.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Seriously?
Here's John Williams.
Do we have to do that now and again? It's 108. This is John. I'm following that active shooter situation, too, in a different sort of way. So we will report to you what we can when we can. We're here until 3 o'clock. As always, I'm WGN King John on social media. That's on the Facebook, on Twitter, and on Instagram, and it's on Facebook right now. It's interesting. So this is from Fox 13 News in Panama City Beach. Police in Panama City, Florida, are responding to reports of an active shooter. There has been no official confirmation from police, but social media users are reporting SWAT officers and a large law enforcement presence along Beck Avenue on the city's west side. Streets in the area are being blocked off. This does not say it's at a school. Footage shows Panama City Police and Bay County deputies on the scene, along with Florida Highway Patrol and even the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. Hold on, I'm looking at it on Facebook. Some users are reporting that gunfire has been exchanged. You just heard Kim talk about that with an unknown suspect. Several gunshots were audible in a live Facebook feed from the scene around 1:30. The Panama City News Herald reports that two nearby schools are being locked down as a precaution, but this is not being reported as an active shooter at a public school. That's in Panama City Beach. That's from Fox 13 News. That was posted a little while ago, about a half an hour ago. But what's interesting is in the adjoining story, the video is from Megan Bell, and she's live on Facebook. This is what people do now. When they have something extraordinary happening, they just put it up on Facebook, and you can feed it live. You know, the live stream on Facebook is really something rather exceptional. And so here's a woman getting out of a car saying, okay, Facebook, here's what I'm seeing. And before the TV stations can get there, if you've got a phone, you're a live reporter. But I don't know any more than that. Although I could kind of click through. Now it's sort of tempting, Steve, because I want to click through and kind of watch and see what this one woman was reporting. And she's got her phone. She's standing on the corner. She's a bystander. There's some news crews. There's a bunch of squad cars. And I don't know anything more about it other than that. But boy, you just don't, it seems like we don't get a day off anymore, does it? We could use a break. I believe Violetta was really another one or something like that. And so we'll keep you posted on that, let you know what we know when we know it. It's 110 on WGN, not a fun way to start the show. Here's another story that just kind of caught my ear, and I mentioned it to Steve before we sort of handed off programs before the news, and that is, so somebody has won $1 million. I don't know exactly the game, but it's a scratch and sniff contest they have for the Illinois Lottery. And if you get all five numbers, you get $1 million. And then there's a multiplier number, and the number this time was four. So somebody's won $4 million at the BP station on Cermak. There's more than one. I don't know the exact address, but you probably do if you have that ticket. And if you haven't turned it in yet, you've got a year. I don't blame you. How long would you go before you turned it in? How long would you go before you told your family? And wouldn't that be a fun thing to imagine doing? I think about this all the time. And I think if I had the $4 million ticket right now, I would put it in a lockbox, as Al Gore used to say, and then I would not tell anybody for a while.
That's the craziest thinking I've ever heard in my whole life.
Because here's what you can do with that. Thanks for asking what my rationale is. First of all, you could pose challenges to family members or friends. You could tell your kids, hey, listen, I know you're not happy with that job you've got, but you feel locked in. Well, I just want you to quit that and follow your dream, knowing full well that if it doesn't go well, they may be screwed. But, oh, wait, we have $4 million here, so we're good to go.
But it's easier to follow your dreams once you know you have $4 million.
Yeah, but then it's not really following your dream, right? Like, I want somebody to, like, take a risk. You know, just take that bold leap and go where your heart belongs.
You're asking too much. It's not practical. It's not reasonable.
But isn't that what they say in the self-help books? You've got to go ahead and just, you know, quit that unhappy job you've got.
Not everyone can follow their dreams.
But that's what they say to do. And you could encourage somebody to do that knowing you've got the safety net now in your back pocket.
Two things. First of all, I'm assuming that the person who's got that ticket doesn't know it.
Oh, I would. If it was me, I would know it, and I still wouldn't have turned it in.
And if I had that ticket, I would have turned it in the next day, because I'd much be more fearful of losing the ticket.
I know. Hey, listen, I'm looking for some keys right now I can't find, and they're pretty important to me, too.
Could you imagine? I swear I had the ticket. Oh, God. It's giving me anxiety even thinking about it. I would lose it.
I would rip it.
I would drop it in a pile of mud. I don't even know. I would lose it somehow.
Go to Home Depot or Office Max or whatever those places are where they sell those little safes. Or you could go to the bank. They still make banks.
You mean the little safes you can pick up and carry around?
Yeah. Well, I mean, just stick the ticket in there and put it in your closet. Nobody's going to know to look there.
I'd carry the safe around with me. No, don't worry. I don't have anything in here. Just my lunch.
But all right, forget about manipulating your kids. You could turn to your spouse and say, "Do you love me?" Or you could turn to your boss and say, I mean, just think about how much leverage you have now when you've got that $1 million ticket in your pocket.
Doesn't mean anything till you have the money in your bank.
Well, I'm willing to believe, even in Illinois, that eventually I'd get my, what did I win, $4 million? I'll probably get $2.75 or $3 million, something like that.
This money has made you a little bit manipulative.
Yeah, but in a good way. But in a good way. Mm. I think I would like to live a life, because by the way, once you announce that you have the money, your life's changed now. Right? Now you aren't the person without the $1 million.
You know why?
Why?
Because you've got the money.
I know that, but it's now you've got people hitting you up, and life gets complicated in ways that you also don't want. So the time between you cashing in that ticket, you getting that ticket and you cashing it in, that's Christmas Eve every day. That's the best part. That's the best part of having the ticket, is the time before. You could run up your credit cards. You could buy a car. You could act silly. You could act crazy. Your wife would say, "Hey, what's going on with you? You sure seem to be happy these days. You probably perform better at work, right?" But then once you say, "Oh, but it's because I got this $1 million ticket," people are going to go, "Oh, how about you take us to lunch? How about you donate to the Salvation Army? How about you give us a wing at the hospital?"
Well, telling everyone's a little bit different than telling your wife and kids. I mean, I don't think I would just go around telling everyone, "Hey, guess what happened yesterday? I won $4 million. But there's a couple people in your life where you would tell them almost instantly. How do you keep that from someone?
I'm picturing Violetta keeping that secret in.
Oh, right, because I can keep a secret. I would be so excited.
Brendan'd say, "Boy, John, you are in an awful good mood these days." I'd be taking days off. Sandy, you had a question or question about my sort of theory? What was that?
Well, I think your theory is a little bit on the crazy side, because what if you get hit by a truck tomorrow and now nobody in your family knows that you've got that $4 million ticket stashed away?
Yeah.
And now your family's missing out on the $4 million.
That would be terrible.
You didn't tell anything.
Yeah.
Yes, it would be terrible.
Okay, I carry
they
around...
They deserve the money, even if you get hit by a truck.
I carry around in my wallet a little note.
No, you just turn it in as soon as you get it.
Yeah. All right, Sandy, thanks for the call.
All right.
You're way too rational for me today. Way too intelligent for me today. Speaking of rational, did you see this story? So Scott Pruitt was speaking at a EPA hearing. Listen to this. Journalists from CNN, the Associated Press, and the trade publication E&D were barred by the EPA from entering the event, which was focused on harmful chemicals in the water. A handful of other reporters from other news organizations were allowed inside the event after having been previously invited by the agency. But CNN shows up at this Scott Pruitt event, and you know what they said? "There's just not enough room in this conference area where we're having the announcement of this talk that he's giving, a national summit of some sort." And so they told CNN that they just didn't have enough room at the inn.
And AP, I think, right?
And AP, and a publication called E&D and some others. So they said there just wasn't enough room. Now, I don't know anything more about it than you now have just heard. This is a little bit longer story, but that's it, right? But you're in Washington, D.C., a cabinet member is talking at an event. Maybe we get the bigger room. They said they had room for 10 journalists. I have a very small condo. I have room for 10 journalists, and we hardly ever have cabinet members over. If a cabinet member was coming over, we would have gotten a room at the Holiday Inn that could have accommodated more people. This just doesn't wash, right? I mean, like, it's convenient. Well, if you only have room for 10, if you only have room for 10, then you could tell somebody they couldn't come. What I don't have in front of me is AP wasn't in, CNN wasn't in. Who was, right? I don't know. But if you ask me, did Fox News get a press pass, I would bet that they did, right? And maybe NBC and CBS are there too. But we all know how the press... I'd like to know if the New York Times had a shot at it or if the Washington Post, who was in and who was not. Because otherwise it smells pretty bad. Jahan Wilcox, an EPA spokesperson, said the agency barred reporters from attending due to space limitations inside the venue, which makes me laugh every time I read that. The EPA was able to accommodate only 10 reporters, and it provided a live stream, they said, for those who we could not accommodate. So you can watch it, but you can't ask uncomfortable questions. That was simply an issue of the room reaching capacity, said the spokesperson, which reporters were aware of prior to the event. A report published by The Hill, however, said that a handful of seats in the press section remained vacant by the time Pruitt began speaking. Additionally, the Associated Press said in a story that one of its reporters denied entry, was grabbed by security guards, and forcibly shoved out of the building after asking to speak to an EPA public affairs person. CNN was also blocked from attending the summit. A CNN photographer was screened by security guards before the event and was waiting for an escort or further information, never got in. Here's the other thing, too. Doesn't the government work for us, right? Like, say you don't want the reporters to be there because you don't like what they're going to say or the pictures they're going to take. I understand that, but I don't know that you should even have the right to say who does or doesn't get press credentials to the White House or to a congressional hearing or to this EPA Scott Pruitt's speech. I mean, within reason, right? Not everybody can go to the White House press briefing room. There should be some sort of accommodation for the mainstream media and then maybe some other people. In fact, now that I think about it, Steve, when Donald Trump first became president, I thought they tried a really good idea. They had a really good idea.
The Skyping thing?
Yeah. I don't know whatever happened to that. And I think they were also going to rotate local news anchors, right? So the gang from Channel 9 would get a chance to either Skype in a question or be there, but they would sort of accommodate different voices.
Yeah, that's a gimmick. I mean, you know,
well,
it is a gimmick.
But it's not a bad one.
As gimmicks go, it's not terrible, no.
Well, but I mean, I think...
But remember, there's like Sean Spicer was like, okay, I'm going to now go to the empty chair and talk to the people in Little Rock, Arkansas. And it was almost...
That's a big deal to the people in Little Rock, Arkansas.
I know, but it was almost demeaning to them, like, well, they'll ask safe questions.
Yeah.
You know, and they didn't always, but...
Well, but I mean, they're breathless. I mean, it's my big shot.
Sure.
Can you imagine sitting in your studio there in Little Rock at KARN, and they say, okay, let's go to Steve Bertrand, and you say, and everybody in Little Rock is going, what question are you going to ask? What's the big question? You got one question, right?
Right.
The only way you maybe are good at that is if you're in the room a lot, if you're part of the flow.
I'd like to defer my question to one of the experts who actually covers the beat.
And that's why I don't like you, because you're making it sound like people in Little Rock don't have questions as good as, or aren't as smart as, or as legitimate as you and me or the people in Washington, D.C.
Well, I think the Trump administration used it as a way to, it was like the Instapot release of the steam. You know, let's go to Schenectady when things got
tough. Whenever things got hot and heavy.
Right. So I think maybe they were thinking that, too.
Let's go to Tim in a basement in Schenectady. Tim, welcome.
And I don't mean that they can't ask good questions or wouldn't, but they're also not there covering it every day. And so they are not experts on the beat of it every day. So I think their questions, not that this is a negative thing, but just naturally would be a little less informed than people who are on the beat.
And in principle, though, again... not everybody should have access to the White House. I think that's sort of special, you know, only because it is so important and potentially dangerous, right? You just can't let anybody in there. But if it's Scott Pruitt speaking at an EPA thing, about hazardous chemicals in water. Not that I really want to be there. But, you know, it's got Pruitt's kind of an interesting character in the administration right now. And I can see where CNN would follow that more closely than I would. And I'd like them to be there. And if it's boring, don't do anything about it. And if it's interesting, tell us what you got, the journalists. If the EPA, though, or the administration is mad at CNN, I don't like the idea of them barring them. I don't think, you know, because it's not a private company. It's the government of the people of the United States of America. As a citizen, I think the media should have access to my representatives.
Well, here's the embarrassing thing for the administration. They disinvited CNN, but they sent the disinvitation through Amazon.
He's funny. All right, it's 122. As always, the number's 312-981-7200. We welcome calls. We welcome texts.
Can I just say something? I haven't read too much about this, John.
Yeah.
But I'm just reading the top couple sentences from NBC News, and they say that one of the journalists said she had been grabbed and shoved aside.
I see that, too.
EPA said there was no room, but later reversed course and let the reporters in.
Oh, so CNN eventually got in there?
Well, I'm just, like I said, I just opened it up. That's the first line from NBC.
I'll pause here. We'll continue to follow that. There was a report of a shooter in Panama City or Panama Beach in Florida. We'll keep you posted on that, too. It's 123. Dean, this is John. You're on the air. What can we do for you?
Hey, John. How are you?
Good. What's up?
Good. You know, I was thinking about the issue with the CNN, and what it comes to mind is the how President Obama had his words with Fox. And I recall back in 2009 how the Treasury Department barred Fox from an event, and then the same type of course this recently happened, sounds like, then there was an uproar, and then Fox was let in. So I really think it's not has to do with the Trump administration, or it's really you see all the presidents, they pick their favorite coverage. And it was obvious President Obama and Fox didn't get along, and he didn't care for them, and he didn't go on any of their Sunday shows ever.
Yeah.
I would argue, though, I don't think the Obama White House ever kept Fox News reporters out of a news event.
No, the Treasury Department did.
In 2009, you got a better memory than me. So nine years ago, the Treasury Department did not.
Barred Fox.
And, you know, if that's the case, no, I'm not arguing with you, but I'm just putting two and two together here. If that's the case, they shouldn't have done it then any more than they should have done it now. Don't you think, Dean,
agreed,
that the power would be at the podium? Just don't call on Fox or CNN if you don't want to, right?
I completely agree with you, Jim. And, John, and actually, I didn't know that fact until I was waiting on hold. And I looked it up, and I went, oh, that's the fact. I go, because I remember there was an issue. And
wow.
I don't have a memory like that. And I looked, and I go, oh, CBS News reported on 2009, this was the event, and this is what happened.
Wow.
So, but I agree with you. They should all be brought in. It should be NPR, Fox, whomever, and just choose not to call on them. I agree. But what troubles me at times is that we have selective outcry. So we should have, you know, had the outcry then, and then we should have also say, hey, you know, it's not just one administration that's doing this. It's systematic of the government we live in. We live in a republic, and we have this issue where there the press and the president are going to be combative. That's the natural progression. But we all look at it through our own filter at times. And I think as a country, I would wish we all just dialed it down and stopped looking through our filter and say, you know what, maybe this isn't just today this happened. Maybe it did happen in the past, and let's learn from the past.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting. I appreciate your phone call, Dean. Thanks for joining us. This is a tweet from Michael Cohen. I actually did a screen grab of it today because I thought it was interesting. And I think I am inclined to agree with this a little bit, except that it's Michael Cohen. But here's what Michael Cohen tweeted. The problem today is if you don't watch the news on television or cable and or read the newspapers, you are uninformed. However, if you do watch the news on television, cable, and or read the newspapers, you are misinformed. And there's the danger of that. I mean, that's a partisan view, but I think he's tippy-toeing around a pretty big truth there. He said, The problem today is if you don't watch the news on television, cable, and or read newspapers, you are uninformed. That's unimpeachably true. However, he says, if you do watch the news on television, cable, and or read the newspapers, you are misinformed. I would say it depends on who you're watching.
Absolutely.
And you may be underinformed. Somebody may report something some way, truthfully, but it may not include an angle that you are interested in or supports your view. But I think he's close to a pretty profound point there, which is hard to imagine me saying that. It's 1:31. Steve's going to do the news. That's next on WGN. It's 1:42, light snow here at WGN, but it's going to be warm someday. And when it does, people will be driving. We'll be enjoying our spring and summer. I mean, shoot, Memorial Day weekend is next weekend. That's the big driving season.
Wait, is it snowing?
Well, it's not really snowing, but I mean,
okay.
You know what? But isn't that telling? Because it's been so dang cold and miserable that you bit on that, Violetta. There's some slick spots on the road, especially the overpasses. Some of them are really slippery because of the ice.
It's not that cold out. I don't even have a jacket.
In our studio right now, I want you to meet somebody, is Frances Wright. She's an Allstate agency owner for how many years, Frances?
30 years.
Wow. In what neighborhood?
In the Beverly area.
You lived there your whole life?
No.
Where
I don't
from?
Live there now. I'm from Chicago. I'm actually from the Woodlawn area.
Ah.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got into the business of insurance, huh?
Yes.
Did you work for an agent and then sort of eventually just buy your own, or how does that happen?
No, I worked in the olden days in what we call Regional Operations Center, where they used to do data processing. So we actually had to input every application by hand. That's where I started off. And what happened, we had some salesmen. Managers, they used to come through there all the time because they wanted us to process their business quicker so they could win different contests. And so they saw the long hours that I worked, and they were saying, hey, if you can work out here with all these long hours, you would just be great as an agent. So I thought about it, and I had a young son at the time. I needed more flexibility and wanted to make more income. So eventually I switched over to sales.
So you were a bit of an insurance wonk, but now you're a business person when you're out there on your own. That must have been a little terrifying.
Yes, it was very terrifying.
And you got to build up a client base too, right?
I sure did, yeah.
How do you do that?
Well, you start off being very scared and
like any independent business person.
Exactly.
You eat peanut butter sandwiches for 5 years.
Right. Yes.
And then but I suppose, I mean, this is one thing I think we've all discovered with the Allstate agents we've dealt with is that, you know, you got to know the numbers, you got to know the program, you got to know insurance, mm-hmm. but you've got to like people. You've got to be a pleasant person, don't you?
Definitely.
You're in sales.
Yes, yes. You do have to be a pleasant person. You have to be someone that just kind of understands people, different types of people. You know, you have people that are, you know, really sharp. You have people that are impatient. You have people from different economic backgrounds, different ethnic groups. So you learn how to deal with those people.
Especially in Beverly. That must be just an interesting neighborhood.
Yes, it is. It's a really nice neighborhood, though. Nice, beautiful homes there. But I don't just serve Beverly. I serve the Chicagoland area.
I see. You know, and I preface this conversation because I said driving season is coming up. And I'm thinking... I happen to know that you guys have some interesting thoughts, ideas, and programs for drivers, right?
Yeah.
One of them, I know we talked about this off the air, is the DriveWise Telematics Program. What is that?
Well, the DriveWise program, it's a great program. It basically, the telematics program can actually show you real time how you're doing as a driver. So it started off with me offering it more like a discount for our clients, even though they can achieve discounts on their policy with the DriveWise app. But it has evolved into more into that because it's a way for people to see how they're driving, if they're speeding a lot, if they're doing a lot of harsh braking.
It's an app on my phone.
Yes, it's an app you could download on
and
your
phone.
And it
knows if I'm going 55 or 75 or whatever.
Or 80 or 85, yes.
Or if my kid's going 85.
Definitely, yes.
Actually, do people use it that way? Do they monitor their children's behavior or to just be a sort of safeguard to themselves?
I think initially people start calling in because they were trying to see why didn't they get a maximum discount. And so the conversations just came up where we could show them how they were really driving. And so we could say, hey, you've been driving over 80 miles an hour. Look at the number of times you were doing that. So then it did become into like a conversation we can have regarding safety.
So if, but is that an incentive then? So if my app displays that I've been a safe driver, you told me it monitors like severe braking and things like that.
Yes, it does.
Okay, so if I can demonstrate that I'm a safe driver mm-hmm. based on the use of this app,
yes,
I would get a discount then?
Yes, you would. Yeah.
What other safety tips do you have for folks that are driving over the holidays or this summer?
Well, some of the safety tips that I came up with, number one, yeah. You want to guess what it is?
Don't use your phone while you're driving.
You are just so awesome. Yes. No texting. Yeah. And don't use your phone while you're driving. You're right. No drinking. How about that?
Boy, one's as bad as the other anymore. That's you see
right.
People, you can't tell if they're drunk or if they're texting.
Right, you can't.
Yeah.
And then how about no racing? Don't get out there racing.
Yeah.
And then keeping your car in good condition. That's another good one. And then also, I would say, I really want to talk a little bit about DriveWise about with young drivers, with teenage drivers, because there's a lot of peer pressure, too, for teenagers to drive fast and to text and get on the phone. So we know this weekend is Memorial Day weekend, and unfortunately, between Memorial Day and Labor Day is known as the 100 deadliest days of fatal car crashes for teenagers, so especially high time during this time. So you could use the telematics program to kind of coach your children how to drive too. Because, you know, they're going to be going to prom, they're going to have graduation, some of them are going to be driving, going away to school for the first time.
Yeah.
So it could really be used to help them.
So if I'm an Allstate customer, I get that free if I want that app?
You know what? Allstate is so awesome, and they are so committed to helping keeping people safe, whether you're a customer or not. You can download the app for free on your phone, as long as you have a smartphone.
Do Android. I get a discount if I just download the app?
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
When you first start it, you get 3% off. Yep.
3% off my premium?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And 15%, up to 15% if I'm a safe enough driver?
That's right, yeah.
See, I'm a good student here. I'm paying attention.
You are very smart.
I do a talk show. All right, Francis Wright with Allstate in Beverly, right?
Yes.
You're on Southwestern?
Yes, 9013 Southwestern.
Well, it's nice to meet you. Thanks for coming into our studio. Everybody drive safe. I think that's a smart way to remember it. The 100 most dangerous days for teen drivers mm-hmm. are between the two summer holidays.
Yes.
So let's make it safe for them and shoot, get that app and use it.
That's right.
Nice to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
It's 1:51, light snow falling downtown Chicago here on WGN Radio. This is John Williams. And if you believe that, I've got a job for you in traffic. No, you're not biting over there? I can't get a ring out of you?
That was very funny.
Yeah. By the way, have you been watching TV? I have seen commercials lately for Facebook, Uber, and Wells Fargo that all had something in common. So I Googled them. I Googled Uber, Facebook, and Wells Fargo 2 days ago. And lo and behold, there is a story on CNN.money.com about the apology ad campaigns they're all running right now. And it was really interesting. Wells Fargo said, we know we screwed up, jacking you guys around with all those accounts that you didn't need. And Facebook's had those data privacy issues, and Uber's had all kinds of problems. And so all of them are spending a lot of money on national TV campaigns admitting as much, which I think is really fascinating. Any one of them is a little surprising, but to see three of them at the same time, sometimes a couple of them in the same stop set on TV, is surprising. And CNN Money noticed too. The person who wrote about that is going to join us in the next hour. I'm looking forward to that conversation. Look who also just popped into our studio, Dr. Sanjay Yadla, who is a board-certified neurosurgeon. He's with the Amida Health Neurosciences Institute. He's an expert on minimally invasive spine surgery. Dr. Yadla, welcome to our show. How are you today?
I'm doing fine, thanks. Thank you for having me.
The Amida Health Neurosciences Institute, what's that?
That is an institute based out of Elk Grove Village, where we have a collection of some of the best neurosurgeons, neurologists, and neuropsychologists in the area.
And the idea is to help people with bad back pain?
That is one of the focuses, is patients with chronic back pain or neck pain. We do have pain specialists as well in the Institute.
I guess it could come, it could be chronic, or it could be some sort of emergency accident somebody happened. You'd see either end of the spectrum, huh?
That's right. We see patients having chronic or acute back pain as well.
Seems like everybody's got back pain. I mean, if you're over, pick a number, 50, you're going to have back pain, right?
Yeah, it's a very common disease within the population.
I got questions for you about that. But do you have any like ballpark advice? Like, you see people living lives and you go, I wish you wouldn't do that because you're going to be seeing me sooner than later because you're doing that.
I think the biggest risk factor these days is obesity, and that just puts a lot of stress on the spine.
Really?
And affects your mechanics as well.
I thought you were going to say you don't bend at the knees.
That's also helpful. Yeah.
But really, number one to you, it's just like, folks, it's just like, how many times do we have to hear it? How many different reasons are there to manage your weight, manage your health? But that just puts more pressure on your spine, huh?
That's right.
Yeah. So now you guys do minimally invasive surgery. What is that all about?
So over the last 20 years, there's been a great advance in the instruments and techniques that we use to perform spine procedures. And that's all led to smaller incisions, shorter days in the hospital, less pain after surgery, and an earlier return to normal activities after surgery.
Is that arthroscopic, where you just look through a little tube and a camera?
That is part of it. There are other tubular retractors and microscopes and computers that we use in the operating room to help us do these procedures.
Is it mostly just working on the tissue or whatever that it's not cartilage. What is the tissue between the spine? The vertebrae.
It's the disc, which is a type of cartilage. Yeah. There are also ligaments that support the spine and the bony elements of the spine as well.
So you're replacing that? You can actually do that with minimally invasive surgeries?
We can replace or clean out a lot of the issues with patients with chronic back pain who have successful outcomes after spine surgery. There's a pinched nerve involved. And yeah. So a lot of what we do is try to go in and unpinch the nerve.
Right. How successful are you on that?
When it's when the patient has had chronic back pain, or usually with a nerve pinching type symptom as well, whether it's numbness or tingling or pain, when a patient has those sorts of symptoms, the surgery can be very, very helpful for them.
How big of a predictor of the positive outcome is following up on the physical therapy? Because nobody wants to do that.
Yeah, physical therapy is a big part of it. It's very important to return to normal activities, but with some supervision, and that's where a therapist can really help out.
People are probably terrified of going to see a spine surgeon, aren't they?
Yes, that's not uncommon. They are often afraid of seeing a surgeon, but we at Amita Health, we do a lot as far as educating patients about what to expect before surgery, during surgery, after surgery. We also spend time with their families to make sure that they have a good support system once they get back home.
That's Dr. Yodla, who is with the Health Neurosciences Institute. This is Amita Health, and Dr. Sanjay Yodla is one of the physicians over there. If you want to schedule an appointment with a specialist at the Amita Health Neurosciences Institute, just call 877-596-7398, 877-596-7398. Or as we like to say, just go to amitahealth.org, this time amitahealth.org/spine surgery for more information. Nice to meet you. Keep up the good work. We appreciate you coming in.
Thank you.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
Mm-mm. All right, it's 2:07. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. And we're here till 3.
Lord have mercy.
Weekdays and on Saturdays, 10 a.m. until 12 noon. By the way, this weekend, speaking of Saturdays, it's the Bike the Drive. You get to ride up and down Lakeshore Drive. Violetta did that last year, bought herself a new bicycle.
A nice Schwinn bike.
Yeah. Made in America Schwinn bike?
Sure. I got it from Target. I don't know.
Schwinn's used to be made in America, and I don't know if they still are.
And Bike the Drive's on Sunday.
Sunday, yeah. As I described a little while ago, I can think of 3 TV commercials right now for 3 separate major American companies, Facebook, Wells Fargo, and Uber, and they're running what I would describe as apology campaigns. And when I Googled it, I saw a story, and it was written by Danielle Wiener Bronner, who is with CNN Money, and she joins us now on WGN Radio. Hi, Danielle. It's John Williams. How are you today?
Hey, I'm great, John. How are you?
Pretty good. I guess this isn't entirely novel. I mean, other companies have found themselves in unfortunate situations, and they've run campaigns to explain it. But it's kind of interesting, at least to me, that we have three major American corporations doing damage control right now, don't we?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting timing. All of these ads for Facebook, for Uber, and for Wells Fargo have come out over the past 3 weeks. I think it's a bit of a coincidence. I know some of these companies have been working on their campaigns for months. Facebook started testing it even before the Cambridge Analytica data breach scandal broke. So these have been in the works for quite some time, and they just all happened to go up around the same time.
What's Facebook trying to do? What's the message? What are they trying to fix?
Sure. So actually, what's common to all three of these companies is they are telling their customers that they would like to win back their trust. So for Facebook, it's, you know, they are talking to consumers who may have been disenchanted by fake news, by clickbait, by this data breach, and they're saying, we're there with you. We know that you were upset. We know that you might have a little bit of a hard time coming back to us, but we are making changes, and we hope that you will join us again.
What's Uber saying right now?
Uber is saying something a little bit different. This ad features a new CEO who is making a direct appeal to consumers to trust him and trust that he is leading a culture change at the company. He tells users that he's been, over the past 9 months since he joined Uber, listening a lot, listening to concerns, and also taking stock of the good that the company has been doing.
I thought that was interesting, too, because if the culture at Uber is inconsiderate to women, that's something they needed to address. But how does that affect me as a consumer? And yet, maybe I'll answer my own question. Because I do know some people who will use Lyft instead of Uber, not because Lyft is inherently better, but because they're mad at Uber. So I guess that's the message that he's trying to get out there, huh?
Yeah, I think that he's saying, you know, regardless of why people may have been leaving, there were a few different scandals that the company was facing over the past year or so. So, you know, and the ad doesn't really go into detail about what happened, but it's
right.
You know, you may have been disappointed in us, or you may have, I mean, not verbatim. But,
wink, wink, know what we mean? Yeah,
sure. They make allusions to reasons that people may have, like you said, decamped to Lyft or looked at other alternatives, but they're saying we're going to move things in a different direction, and it's sort of up to the consumer to say, okay, I'm not sure what they're talking about, but I do believe them, or to bring their individual issues if they have them to mind.
Yeah, but I wonder, and this would be a good question for you, at 312-981-7200, if you saw either of those commercials, did it change your attitude about the company, and did it make you more inclined to, say, go back on Facebook, or to, in fact, use Uber instead of Lyft? Because that's what they're doing. I mean, I haven't thought about Uber in that way for a while, right? I know when that stuff first hit, when they had the problem with the CEO, the company was in a lot of turmoil. And some people were then putting Lyft on their phone. But then it was sort of out of the news. That hasn't been a big story lately. At least it hasn't been resonating with me. So I think the question becomes, should they have just sort of been quiet about it? Or should they conjure this back up in hopes that people will get back on board, you know?
Right, that's a great question. And I think, you know, with Uber more than the other two, there isn't really much detail given about what the company has faced in the past. There is a little bit of a reintroduction or a primary introduction to the new CEO, who maybe hasn't been quite as much in the spotlight as the old CEO was. So this could just be, if you're not really thinking about Uber in a negative light, you might just say, oh, here's this new guy. I haven't seen him before. He's the face to the app, and this is what Uber is about today.
The imagery in the Facebook ad is really nice. It's almost like Facebook was just invented. Hey, we've got this thing, and you can connect with your friends. And, you know, it's sort of harkened back to what you originally thought social media or Facebook could be or should be when it's best. And it's a nice ad, but it also strikes me as a little, I don't know, it just seems to be a little out of time and place until you think about the message. It was, we're sorry. We're sorry that we were sharing your data. We're sorry that you feel threatened. We're sorry that this thing has turned sinister. And so here's this much more rosy picture of what Facebook can be, people sharing moments and stuff like that, right?
Certainly. I think there's a little bit of a nostalgia play there. I think that people who have been using Facebook over the past however many years will recognize the imagery. They'll recognize maybe the older news feed or kind of relate to that feeling of seeing one of your friends post a video or an image that you like. Oh. So there is a little bit of a calling to that original message of Facebook, which is we are helping you build stronger relationships.
Right. You notice that the post they were showing don't begin, hey, snowflakes, it's time you guys got with the program, or something super political or something mean. I mean, Facebook is a lot of things these days, and they aren't all rosy, but that's what they want to remind you Facebook can be. A friend of mine has an idea that he's going to come up with his own new app, and it's going to be like Facebook, but it's going to find some way to filter out all of the negative news and all of the negative commentary. I mean, a lot of us want that sort of, I don't know, that version of Facebook that I'm describing. And a buddy of mine thinks he's got to figure out how to do it. I'm not sure he does have it figured out, but if he does, I think he's going to become a zillionaire, right?
Yeah, I think that Facebook certainly is hoping that users will remember that time, and I think that Facebook is making an effort to go back to kind of a pure experience of we know that you're here for your friends, and yeah, we want you yeah. back here for your friends.
And then there's Wells Fargo. And you and I talked about this yesterday off the air. So Wells Fargo, I don't know if people in Chicago are as familiar with the story as I am, because I was a Wells Fargo customer. I lived in Minneapolis. They have a huge footprint there, much less so in the Chicago area. So when I moved from the Twin Cities to Chicago, we got a new bank here that had more branches and had a bigger footprint. I think a lot of us sort of do that thing. So we cut ties with Wells Fargo. But Wells Fargo was busted and had to pay a ginormous fine because they put so much pressure on personal or business bankers to generate revenue. And how do you do that? Well, you get people to sign up. And how do you get them to sign up? Well, you offer them products and services. And once you get them in the door, you get them to open up a lot of accounts which generate fees. Well, some people didn't ask for these accounts at all. Some people had no idea they had as many accounts as they did. They didn't need them. They didn't want them. And now they're on this fee treadmill that maybe they didn't even realize. Or if they did, they thought, oh, well, that's my bank. And when people found out about that, it hit the fan. Okay, that's the Wells Fargo backstory. I don't know if people know that in Chicago so well. But now here's Wells Fargo with the stagecoach and the horses coming, and they say, you know, we started out as a reliable company. And then they show a newspaper headline, and they say, and then it hit the fan. Not exactly that. You get the idea. And then they said, and now we're going to go back to being the way we used to be. They even show a headline from a newspaper saying Wells Fargo, you know, is in trouble. And so here again, I guess the question is, in this case, should they run that ad or should they not, Danielle? What's your sort of general reaction to that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think in the case of Wells Fargo, they have, you know, what you described, that backstory is not so recent anymore. This is something that they've been trying to come back from for nearly 2 years at this point. So, you know, in this ad, there is that same sort of tactic that Facebook uses, steeping the company in history, saying, you know, maybe you've, over the past 2 years, you've sort of lost faith in us, but remember that we are a part of this country's history. And they do sort of make a specific mention of ending product sales goals there. That is, as you mentioned, that was part of the reason that employees felt pressure to create accounts that customers didn't want. So there is sort of a direct nod to that, but there also is this kind of broader look at Wells Fargo as an American company that has served Americans for more than 100 years. So I think that, you know, is the question, should they be mentioning this to new audiences a good one. I don't really know the answer to it, but I do think that there is a way to receive the ad as saying, okay, well, I'm not maybe entirely sure what happened. Maybe I know a little bit, but what I'm getting from this message is that whatever mistakes have happened are in the past. I would imagine that that's sort of what they're trying to do.
I guess it's the, you know, it's from a moral's not the right word, but, you know, it's the right thing to do. You own your mistake. Say, we're sorry. And by God, we're going to try our best. Zuckerberg is saying that all the time. If you see him on the street and come up to him, he'll say, I'm sorry. We're trying to fix this. We're trying to make it better. Some people are buying it. Some people aren't. But at the end of the day, I think we would all like companies to behave that way, to own your mistakes, move forward, change the culture, you know, apologize. I mean, all the things that these ads are doing, I guess I would ask my kid to do, but I still think it's an intriguing question if the companies should be spending zillions of, you know, millions of dollars advertising like that on TV.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that what we've seen across all of these ads is that the company acknowledges that something went wrong, that a mistake was made, that some customers are no longer happy with the company or no longer trusted in some form, and that all of these companies want to move forward. So, you know, I don't know. I guess it depends on each individual person's relationship with the brand, whether or not they're aware of what happened or whether or not this ad will work. But I do think that the beats that are being hit across all three of these is, this is what we brought to you as a company. This is the service that we offer.
Yeah.
We acknowledge that something happened, and we would like to move on.
Daniel Wiener-Brauner writes for CNNMoney.com, and you can read her online. And I guess the follow-up interview will be in a quarter or in a year to see what the bottom line is of these companies, right? Has this message resonated, and were they able to recapture lost customers or sales?
Right. Yeah, I think that these campaigns have been going now for a couple of weeks, and it's early, but we'll see eventually how they do.
Danielle, thanks for your time today. Stay well.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
You bet. Thanks for joining us on WGN. 63 degrees at O'Hare right now, 62 at Midway, 53 at the lakefront, 73 in what was the little town out west?
Mendota.
Mendota.
I think they have a very nice sweet corn festival, don't they, in Mendota?
Pretty much when you get out that way, the answer is yes. Manuka has a corn fest. Morris has a corn fest.
Morris has the corn fest.
They really do.
Right. There's no comparison.
If that's something you want to brag about, go right ahead. Speaking of companies, Starbucks has a bit of a sort of a quandary that they're facing right now. There's a very interesting story about that in the Wall Street Journal today. And it doesn't have to do with the use of the bathroom. Let me catch you up on that in a minute. This is in the Wall Street Journal today. Starbucks is trying to dig itself out of controversy on Monday by attempting to clarify a policy toward non-paying guests that generated an onslaught of weekend criticism. Did you talk about this on the Business Lunch, Steve Bertrand?
No. Is Starbucks this the no order, no sleep, or no?
Yeah. The right. Seattle-based retailer on Sunday has said that it will allow all guests in its U.S. company-owned stores to use the cafes, including the restrooms, whether or not they make a purchase. Forget about the bathrooms for a second. They leave it up to the individual franchises how you're going to handle situations like this. And I think they still will. But they're going to give guidelines to their local store owners or managers. Let's see, is this the company-owned stores?
Well, they probably own some and then their franchises, right? So they can control what happens in their company-owned.
Yeah, this is the company-owned stores. Okay, so here's what the company says our company-owned stores policy will be. And that is, if you want to use the bathroom, you can. If you want to just drop your laptop there and have no intention of buying coffee, that will be okay too. Which is really weird, right? Because Starbucks sort of feels like a public space, but it's not. They're paying the rent there. You know, I was thinking what I would do. Tell me what you guys think of this. You can use the bathrooms. You can use the tables. We're not going to get into that. Who are we monitoring? Who gets used or not? But we're going to charge you for electricity and Wi-Fi. So if you want to set up and put your office, that's the amazing thing to me is that how willing they are to let people use their electricity and Wi-Fi. And maybe they only spent $2 on a cup of coffee. They sip that for half a day. And instead of paying rent in an office, you can just
or in a co-space or things like that.
Right, yeah, they have those things, those shared spaces, but for $1.89 a day, you could office up at a Starbucks. And I've never exactly understood that, right? Those people are taking up tables that maybe other cash-paying customers would use. You usually seem to be able to get a spot, but they've sort of, you know, they could reduce their footprint. They don't have to have as big a store, right? You could just go in and get coffee and leave.
They can just have no chairs. And then we'll see who stays.
Right. Or you can rent the chair, but we'll sell you a chair for $25 an hour. So they've revisited this, and their new policy is, Monday, Starbucks revealed more about the policy, telling the Wall Street Journal that employees now have detailed instructions on what to do if someone's behaving in a disruptive manner. If you're smoking, if you're using drugs or alcohol, if you're sleeping, you're not supposed to do that. At issue, in essence, is whether Starbucks views itself as a business that caters to customers or a quasi-public space generally welcome to all. While many other restaurants and retailers also must manage the issue of lingering customers and non-paying guests who come in to use the restrooms, Starbucks has promoted itself as providing a third place between home and work where people can freely exchange ideas. I guess that's nice. Nice of them. And that's the policy. If you want to use the bathroom, you don't have to buy a cup of coffee. You want to hang out all day, we're not going to kick you out. As long as you don't fall asleep, as long as you're not drunk, as long as you're not using drugs. So let me see if I got this right, Steve. I just want to go back to the president's tweet over the weekend.
Okay.
I hereby demand, and will do so officially tomorrow. So this was Sunday for tomorrow, yesterday. I hereby demand, and will do so officially tomorrow, that the Department of Justice look into whether or not the FBI, DOJ infiltrated or surveilled the Trump campaign for political purposes, and if any such demands or requests were made by the people within the Obama administration, exclamation point. Talk about turning a thing on its head, right? Because this
right.
investigation is about whether or not the Trump campaign colluded with the Russians. He now wants the Department of Justice to investigate whether or not the FBI
planted a mole
at the request of the Obama administration.
And like I said before, it's all because of the term that was used, spy. I mean, had they used the word informant?
Well, he didn't use the word spy here.
No,
but
I think some
later.
Of the earlier talk did, yeah.
Okay, so then the president's, so then yesterday they said we will have the inspector general's office. This is what Rosenstein came up with. He said, look, we'll have the inspector general's office look into this. They'll open up an investigation themselves. And what they're going to see is not whether or not there was actually somebody in the FBI that was working on this, but rather they're going to see if they did so for inappropriate purposes, political purposes, right? So if the FBI was doing something like that, looking into the Trump campaign, I'm not surprised by that. I hope they did. But if they were doing so to try and hurt his chances, that would be an inappropriate purpose. So it's all about what their motive is.
And they did a terrible job of it.
Right.
I mean, right? That's the other part of it. Think of this. If the FBI was infiltrating to try to defeat Donald Trump,
right?
They didn't talk about anything that they got about it. They didn't even talk about the fact that they were investigating
Well, they
it.
Didn't find the 30,000 email that Hillary deleted.
Yeah, but that wouldn't have been the people inside the Trump campaign. Anyway.
Right, the FBI wouldn't be interested. Okay.
Right.
But so I don't know how you would prove, unless you had and it would be more than just a snarky text between two FBI agents, say, saying, boy, I hope Donald Trump doesn't win, right? But how do you prove that the FBI was actually politically motivated? The organization or individuals were politically motivated and trying to throw the election towards Hillary Clinton. That's what he's asking for.
I know.
Okay,
but look at everything the FBI did.
And if that is the case, then I think the president's on to something here.
So was the James Comey announcement very close to the election that they were reopening the campaign? Was that like a double super secret way to help Donald Trump? I don't understand how that works.
As you know, there were 27 Comey announcements before the election, and one helped, one hurt, one helped, and one hurt. I mean, that's my keeping score on this. Okay. You know, you pause like that doesn't make any sense. Absolutely does. When he said we're opening up an investigation, or we have an investigation that helped Donald Trump. When they closed it, that helped Hillary Clinton. When they opened it back up, that helped Donald Trump. And when they closed it, it was too late. But ostensibly, it was supposed to even the score.
So you think that's why they didn't do it, though, to even the score?
No, they weren't politically motivated. Well, I believe James Comey.
That they weren't politically motivated.
Affirmative.
Yeah, but oddly, they were politically inept.
That too, right? That's the problem
with Comey's
book.
They tried so hard not to be political that they were political.
Absolutely. That Comey, in his defense, I mean, we've talked a lot about that book on this show, but that's the one thing that he doesn't acknowledge, that even if his motives were pure, he had an impact on the election.
Yeah.
And he does not see that still. Okay, so we reached out to a professor over at the University of Chicago School of Law. It's Azik Hook, who is a professor of law at the school over there, and he's listening to this conversation and now joins us on WGN. Aziz, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, great to be here.
So what do you want to say about what we've just said?
Well, I think the real question posed by this week's events is, why is it that the identity of someone who came forward and acting, by all accounts, out of patriotism and a desire to do the right thing, provided information to our national intelligence services, is being outed and dragged through a very public spectacle by elected actors who seem to be poised to reap electoral benefit from doing so.
Okay, that's another part of the story. So who is this person? And Republican members of Congress want information on that. They have not said that they would expose this person, but you've got to believe that that's going to happen, right? That's your fear, isn't it?
Well, the person's name has already been made public by a website called The Daily Caller. And what's happened now is that a news story that might have come and gone without much attention has blown up. It's been escalated in a way that really draws attention to the role that this person may or may not have played, really draws attention to the fact that they were doing work for the intelligence services, and probably most importantly, draws attention to the fact that at least among certain quarters of the government, it appears to be acceptable to out intelligence sources who are, again, by all accounts, not acting on the basis of a pecuniary motive. They're acting on the basis of patriotism and doing what's right.
Yeah.
Those people will be outed for narrowly partisan gain.
Well, and this person you're speaking about is not an FBI agent, but somebody that he was a professor, right, who gave information. Are we talking about the same person?
We are, and there's some inaccuracy or clumsiness in the way that this person has been described in the media. By all accounts, he's not somebody who's in the Trump campaign. He's somebody who reached out to and had contacts with the Trump campaign, in particular with George Papadopoulos, apparently to discuss a commercial venture. And in the course of those discussions, information was revealed that was then passed on to the FBI.
Got it. Okay. So I guess a danger then is, if you are somebody out there who maybe in a random conversation with somebody in a political campaign or something else goes, oh my God, I've discovered something that I think I should tell the FBI. I'll tell the FBI and they'll promise me they'll keep my name out of it. How much assurance do you have now if you're that next person when, in fact, this person's name has been exposed?
This is a point that the director of the FBI, Christopher Wray, made in congressional testimony a couple of weeks ago, where he said very pointedly that both the FBI and the CIA in their counterintelligence and counterterrorism operations depend upon the credibility of promises they make to their human intelligence sources. And what the last 3 days' events have demonstrated to those sources and to potential sources in the future, that whatever promises an intelligence agency makes, if a political superior in the House or in the White House decides that it is politically convenient to reveal information about that source's identity, nothing will stop him.
Does the president, I'm confused about the quote-unquote constitutional crisis, does the Constitution afford the president the ability to ask the Department of Justice to investigate something, including an investigation onto himself? Is that within the law?
The law isn't clear on this question. There is a claim made by some constitutional scholars that the president has unfettered authority to control anything that the Department of Justice does. On the other hand, there's a clear constitutional rule of law concern with having the president interfere with investigations that concern his own behavior or the behavior of those close to him. The important thing to say is that the Constitution is a pretty short piece of text. You know, it doesn't address many, many important questions. It doesn't actually say anything about the president's role in criminal justice beyond the fact that he has the pardon power. So what scholars do when they make claims about these kind of issues is that they kind of construct these Rube Goldberg machines based upon what the Supreme Court said, what happened as a matter of practice. And your listeners should know that it's not the Constitution that's making those claims. It's scholars who are often people who've been Department of Justice lawyers or defense side lawyers.
Okay.
They all have interests.
I get that point, but then let's just narrow it down to this. The president has a point, doesn't he, if in fact the investigation was motivated by political desires, right? If that was a partisan thing, if they wanted to keep Donald Trump from being president, and that's the FBI working with an informant, and the reason they're doing this is to keep Donald Trump from being president, that's a problem, isn't it?
I think if there was a substantial basis for believing that there was improper behavior within the Justice Department, you're right. It would be a problem. That substantial basis for evidence does not, as far as I'm aware, exist. Moreover, even if there was such evidence, we have mechanisms which are tried and tested for dealing with that kind of problem without creating the self-dealing dynamic that the president has created by interfering in an investigation that directly and materially impinges upon his political future.
Well, handicap James Comey for me. My colleague Steve Bertrand and I were going back and forth on did he help or hurt and what his motivation was. How do you score that?
Oh, I'm not a political animal. I have a hard time judging those things.
You think that he affected the election?
I really don't know.
Yeah, I don't either, but I think he did.
I'm a lawyer. I don't call
I see it both ways. Yeah, what do you need? I'll give you whatever you want.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting and at least temporarily diffused, right? I mean, they've
least temporarily diffused. Although you know, no, it doesn't appear that much in this administration stays diffused for long.
Aziz Huq is the Frank and Bernice Greenberg Professor of Law at the University of Chicago Law School. Aziz, very interesting. Join us again. I appreciate your time today.
Would love to. Thanks for having me on the show.
You betcha. It's 2:50. This is WGN. All right, I don't know if you're going to be able to do this or not. We've got a couple of minutes here. Listen carefully. I'm about to play for you a scene from a movie. If you can tell me what the movie is, I will give you tickets to the MB Bike the Drive, which Violetta reminds us is Sunday, May 27th. For almost 5 hours, you'll be able to ride up and down beautiful Lakeshore Drive in Chicago. It's going to be a nice weekend. Plus, there's a fun-filled post-ride festival. Register today at mbbikethedrive.org, mbbikethedrive.org, and use the promo code MBSAVE5. That's the number 5. The promo code is MBSAVE5 to get $5 off. mbbikethedrive.org to register with the code MBSAVE5 to save $5. Now, I've got a family pack of 4 passes to ride up and down Lakeshore Drive on Sunday, but you have to tell me what this scene is from.
Buongiorno! ¿Cómo estás? Oggi è molto umido, non è vero?
Va diavolo!
Kevin is shaking his head like it's way too easy or way too hard. Violetta, do you know the answer to this one? I don't think it's easy. But you hear that? That's a bicycle gears. That's somebody riding a bicycle. Kevin doesn't know. Violetta doesn't know. Oh, good. Well, then it sounds
pleasant.
It is. Actually, what is about to happen to that young man is not pleasant. But you need to tell me what that movie is from, or what scene that is from, and what scene that movie is from, what movie that scene is from. There it is. You need to tell me what movie that scene is from at 312-981-7200, and we'll give you tickets to Bike the Drive. All right, we played the scene from the movie. The question is, what movie was it from? Hey, Don, this is John. You're on WGN. How are you?
Good, King John. How you doing?
Talk to me now. What movie was that scene from?
It's a wild guess, but I'm going to say Breaking Away.
Why is that a wild guess?
Because I have absolutely no idea, but since it's associated with cycling, and, oh, by the way, Mary Vandeveld's relatives were in it, I thought I'd take a shot at it.
Mary Vandeveld's cousin? It was her cousin you're talking about, right?
I think it's her uncle that's actually in
I think you're right. Oh, my God. Our listeners know us better than we do, or better than I do. It's Mary Vandeveld's uncle, Christian Vandeveld, that's the cyclist?
No, her cousin is Christian that's the cyclist, but Christian's dad and Mary's dad were both cyclists also.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I knew Christian, the cousin, but you're saying that the uncle was in this movie?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I'm right on that. Ah. Mary was nice enough to introduce me to Christian one time, and he signed my cycling jersey.
Do you have passes already to Bike the Drive?
I do not have passes to Bike the Drive already.
You do now have four, my friend.
Sweet. You know, once upon a time, I sat in the showcase studio with you and talked about Bike the Drive.
You rode your bike by, as I recall, many times. All right, Don, I'm out of time.
Video to prove it.
I'm done talking to you on the radio.
Thanks, John.
Hold on for just a second. Talk to Dan. We'll get your information and enjoy the MB Bike the Drive on Sunday, okay?
Hope to see you there.